We read this morning in the book of Ruth, the last verse of the first chapter, through to verse 13 of chapter 2. Naomi had left Bethlehem 10 years before with a husband and two sons, and now she has returned, her husband having died, her two sons having died, and with one daughter-in-law, Ruth. Naomi looked at her life and said, God sent me away full, but brought me back empty. But little did Naomi know. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem, significantly, at the beginning of barley harvest. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to his reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short time. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. Then Ruth fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. Sometimes, and I'm sure you have experienced this or discovered this, sometimes in life, seemingly insignificant events turn out to have seismic importance. At the end of chapter 1, we are told that Naomi and Ruth arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And it seems such an insignificant farming event, something that you would expect to read in a book about rural 3rd millennium BC Israel. It was the beginning of the barley harvest. We might say it's the beginning of the football season or whatever, but it was just a seasonal marker, or so it seemed. But to the writer of Ruth, The beginning of the barley harvest is not a mere seasonal marker. It's highlighted because it signals the perfect timing of the covenant Lord's providence, as unfolding events will make only too clear. What appears just an insignificant seasonal marker is actually an indication of the wise, sovereign, purposeful providence of God that brought Naomi and Ruth back to Bethlehem at that particular time. More of that a little later. As chapter 2 begins, we are introduced to the third major figure in the story, the man Boaz. And if you were reading this story for the first time, and perhaps there are some here this morning, and this is the first time you've actually read or heard read for you the story of Ruth, you would wonder who this Boaz was and why is he being introduced at this particular moment in the story. The book of Ruth is a remarkably crafted story. It's a story full of literary ingenuity. If you know anything about Hebrew, it is a vast chiasmus. Don't need to go into that. You can ask Flavian or Palmer or Johnny or Stefan or whoever what a chiasmus is. But it's beautifully constructed and words are chosen deliberately. And here at this moment, Boaz is dropped into the very midst of this unfolding drama. He's a relative of Naomi's husband, dead husband, Elimelech, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. And then the story goes back to Ruth and Naomi. And you're asking, well, why are we being told this? It's a very Hebraic way of telling a story. A little information is dropped in, seemingly out of the blue, only to be picked up later and developed, a bit like a leitmotif in music. Why is he telling us this? And the writer is saying, wait and see. And so the chapter begins with Ruth asking Naomi for permission to glean among the ears of grain. They've come back with nothing. Naomi's a widow. Ruth is a widow. The most vulnerable of people in an ancient rural patriarchal society. And in the law of God, there was a particular privilege given to the poorest of the poor. They were allowed to glean among the ears of the grain, to go after the harvesters and to collect whatever the harvesters had missed. There was provision for the poor. And that's what Ruth is asking Naomi for permission to do. May I go and glean among the ears of the grain? And now the story begins to develop its own internal momentum. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. Now, wasn't that lucky? She just happened, says the writer. She didn't plan. She hadn't heard about Boaz and his relationship through Elimelech to Naomi. She hadn't conceived a plot or a plan or a purpose to go to this particular field. It just happened. Or so it seemed. And the writer very deliberately doesn't pause to say, now, we know that as believers in the sovereign Lord, he is constructing all things to the pursuance of his glory, to the blessing of his church. No, he says, it happened. It happened. Wasn't that lucky? She happened on a field belonging to Boaz. Ruth did not know Boaz nor his relationship to Naomi. Being in his field seemed, as events were turning out, just a lucky break. Who would have thought it? And that's life, isn't it? Life, events happen. Life happens. It unfolds, sometimes surprisingly, sometimes apparently insignificantly, sometimes seismically, though rarely. Life happens. It unfolds. As Ruth sought to do the right and honourable thing for her mother-in-law, as she sought to be a good daughter-in-law, as she sought to provide righteously for this woman who surely had led her to faith in the living God, as she sought to do the right and honourable thing, she came across a man in Bethlehem who had the potential to do her and Naomi great good. There's a beauty in the ordinariness of Hebrew narrative. As Ruth sought to do the right and honourable thing, God blessed her. Always seek in life to do the right thing and the honourable thing, and trust the Lord to direct your paths. You've heard me say often enough, perhaps a little too much, that guidance for a believer is doing the next thing, the next right thing. If you're not sure what the way ahead is for you, do the next right thing, do the next honourable thing, and leave God to order all your ways. It was as Ruth sought to do good to this woman that she happened on a field that belonged to Boaz. Now in the text, you'll notice, we're told some significant things about Boaz. Number one, that he was a relative of Naomi's dead husband. And this fact will become of pivotal importance as the story unfolds, in that Boaz will become what was called a kinsman redeemer. We'll talk about that another time. Number two, he's described in verse one as a worthy man. The writer wants us right at the outset to understand that this Boaz is a man of character. Now there is a subplot here, which is actually the main plot, if you could follow my thinking, because the purpose of Ruth is to show the lineage, the forebears of Israel's greatest king, David. And the writer wants us to understand that Boaz, who's in the line of David, and as we shall see, the line of the Messiah, was a worthy man. He was a man of character, a man to admire. Thirdly, we're told in verse 4, he was a godly man. The normal greeting would have been, Shalom, peace be to you. But he says, the Lord, the covenant Lord, Yahweh, may he be with you. And the writer is signaling again, here is a godly man. Here is a man who lives before God and who seeks to honour God in his life. His business life is all of a piece with his religious life. Then fourthly, we're told, he is a kind, thoughtful, and generous man. He says to Ruth in verse 8, do not glean in another field or leave this one. Keep close to my young woman. I charge the young men not to touch you. How vulnerable a young widow would have been in a society, not least our society today. Here's a man who has kindness and compassion towards the vulnerable. And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. And in verse 13, Ruth can hardly, the language conveys depth of emotion. She can hardly take in what's been happening to her. I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me, spoken kindly to your servant. Though I'm not one of your servants, I don't get it, she's saying. I don't understand why you're being so kind and so comforting and so generous to me. I'm not one of your servants, and yet you're treating me as if I were. He's a thoughtful, kind, and generous man. Now, there's another thing you need to know about Boaz. We're not told about it here, but we're told about it in the opening chapter of the New Testament. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 5. The first 20-odd verses of Matthew are just lists of names, 42 names, 3 14s. That's 42, isn't it? Yeah, 3 14s. 42 names. And in verse 5, you read this. Boaz, whose mother was, who was his mother? Rahab the harlot. His mother was a prostitute, had been until she was converted. She was a woman of the night, a woman of the streets. She was known until she came to put her hope and trust in the living God. She lived a scandalous life. And yet Boaz and Rahab are embedded, not just in David's line, the kingly line, they're embedded in the Messiah's line. Your background, your present background or your past background is no hindrance whatsoever to the living God making you a significant servant of his in the work of his kingdom. Nothing disqualifies you from coming to Jesus Christ except your unwillingness to come to him. Here is a man who had a family history that people would want to bury, but not the Bible. The Bible's very upfront. His mother was Rahab. But wasn't she a harlot? Yes. And God saved her, changed her. I think there are a few passages in the Bible I more love thinking about than 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11, where Paul writes to the Corinthians and says to them, do you not know that the immoral, the ungodly, the perjurer, the liar, the homosexual, the prostitute will not enter the kingdom of heaven? And such were some of you. But you were washed. You were justified in the name of Jesus Christ. God came to you in mercy, cleaned you up from the inside out, gave you a new heart, made you right with himself. That was Boaz. Now go back a little with me and pick up the thread of the narrative before we try and draw out four truths that shine out of the narrative. Ruth happens to glean in a field belonging to this Boaz. She's overwhelmed with Boaz's great kindness to her. It was Ruth's selfless care and love for Naomi that had gone before her. Boaz says, I've heard all about you. I've heard all about you. I know who you are. How you were kind to your mother-in-law, Naomi. Ruth's life was like a sermon that had impacted Bethlehem. And there is something, isn't there, compelling and deeply moving about unaffected, selfless goodness. But of course, the significant thing to note is what Boaz tells us about Ruth's inner life. "I've heard all about you," he said. "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. How you left your father and mother, your land, and came to a people you did not know. The Lord repay you for what you have done. May a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." The great thing that you need to know about Ruth this morning is this. She was a woman who had come to take refuge under the care and love and compassion of the covenant Lord. You've come to take refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. Well, refuge from what? From everything. Yes, refuge from the uncertainties of life. But clearly, above all, refuge from the guilt and power of sin and sin's hideous master, Satan. She had fled for refuge, for salvation. It's a Hebraic picture of salvation from the wrath and judgment to come under the safety and security of the protection and care and love of God. She had fled for refuge to God. Saving faith, the faith that brings us into the salvation of God, is a faith that insists we believe in Jesus Christ. That we believe that he died a sin-bearing, sin-atoning death on Calvary's cross. That we believe that on the third day he rose bodily from the dead, triumphing over sin and death and hell, and that he was raised to the right hand of his Father. Saving faith has these great truths embedded at its heart. But you must never forget that the heart of saving faith is personal allegiance to the person of Jesus Christ. We do not flee to doctrines for refuge. We flee to Jesus Christ, who is the truth of God, and in whom all the doctrines of God find their yes and their yes again. Faith is about sheltering your life under the compassionate wings of the living, eternal God. Is that something you've done this morning? Is that something that you have consciously done? You have gone to take refuge. Refuge from the coming wrath, which is to come. Refuge from the guilt and power of sin. You've come to take refuge, to find security and peace and hope in God himself. Is God your shield and your hiding place? There's one other thing, though, I think. This struck me quite powerfully late last night, thinking about it. That we are told in the passing about Ruth. Boaz says to her, "I've heard all that you did for your mother-in-law. How you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before." In Ruth, there was a radical transfer of allegiance. Belonging to the people of God meant for Ruth leaving her living father and mother, leaving her homeland. That's not something that many perhaps are called to. And yet Jesus said, didn't he, Matthew 10, whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. If I am not the Lord, the King, the Sovereign, who has the cream of your heart, you're not worthy of me. Faith is expressed in allegiance. As for me and my house, said Joshua, we will serve the Lord. Who or what has the first allegiance in your life? Who is the one before whom you live? Put it maybe a little more personally. Who do you live to please? Just briefly as we close, four things to draw the passage together. Number one, a seemingly incidental, even apparently fortuitous event may be significant beyond anything you could imagine. Shouldn't Christians live with bated breath? Shouldn't we rise in the morning, those of us who do rise with our heads somewhat together? Shouldn't we rise thinking, I just wonder what God's going to do today? You just never know what God might do amidst the apparent insignificance of life's everyday events. Ruth began the day gleaning in a field, poor and alone. She ends the day protected, cared for, honored, and having met her future husband. She doesn't quite know it yet, but she has. You just never know. Isn't it exciting being a Christian? It's absolutely overwhelmingly exciting. You just never know what's around the next corner, what seismic event God may be purposing and planning and using you in the midst of it. Because actually, there are no insignificant events at all. They appear insignificant, but they all are being woven into the perfect tapestry of God's purpose. Number two, are you like Ruth living a life that goes before you? Does your life, does my life openly testify whose we are and whom we serve? It was Ruth's selfless kindness that Boaz heard about first. What do people say about you and say about me when we're not with them? You ever wonder that? I'm nosy enough to wonder. What do they say? What do your colleagues say about you when you're not in the room? Is our life going before us, testifying to whose we are and whom we serve? Number three, and let me speak a little more directly to young men and women in church this morning. Young men, how do you measure up to Boaz? He was a worthy man, a good man, a godly man, a kind man, a thoughtful man, a man who spoke openly about the Lord. Is that you? Or you married men, do your wife and children see Boaz in you? As we read that, were they thinking, that's my dad? Do the young women in church this morning see Boaz in any of the young men? Of course, the question can be put to young women too. How do you measure up to Ruth? I don't just mean are you kind to perhaps a future mother-in-law, though that's no bad thing. Ruth was spirited. I like that about Ruth. She was someone asked me at a conference I spoke at in the States a couple of years ago, and what do you think Christian women should be like? I said, spunky. They said, exegete, please. So I said, women with spirit. Women with initiative. That's Ruth. She was kind. She was selfless. She was hardworking. She lived a life that shouted out, I've taken refuge under the wings of the covenant Lord. Ruth and Boaz are not idealized portraits of believers. They're believers who were living out their faith. That's all they were doing. Finally, God bends the ordinary providences of life to the fulfilling of his purposes. The story of Ruth is actually not the story of Ruth, though it is the story of Ruth. And it's not the story of Naomi, though it is the story of Naomi. It's the story of the effortless way that the Lord God Almighty forwards his purposes in the world through the ordinary events of life. So what's the book of Ruth about? It's about the sovereign Lord, who is orchestrating events in a way that will advance his kingdom and lead to his son, Jesus Christ. That's why it's a helpful question to always ask yourself when you read a passage in the Bible, wherever you are, Genesis, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, 2 Samuel, 2 Chronicles, first question, what have I to learn about Jesus Christ? So think about that for next week, and we'll come back to that. What does this passage teach us about Jesus Christ? An awful lot, actually. But that's for another time. May God bless to us his word.